Welcome to Australian Aviation Radio. I'm your host, Robert Bruss. Australian Aviation Radio is proudly brought to you by Afterburner, accelerating the performance of your organization by teaching flawless execution. Afterburner seminars are dedicated to sharpening awareness, enabling decision-making, taking action, and driving accountability using proven methods developed by military fast jet pilots. To find out more, take action and visit afterburner.com.au. Australian Aviation Radio is the official podcast of the Australian Aviation Magazine. If you haven't already subscribed, pop open your favourite podcasting app and hit that subscribe button, and don't forget to leave us a review. You can visit our website at australianaviation.com.au and make sure you follow along in social media on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and of course on our YouTube channel. On today's show, we celebrate a milestone with one of Australia's most successful aviation businesses, Jabiru. 2018 marks 30 years since Jabiru was conceived, and we're joined by the founder, Rodney Stiff. With a background in farm machinery, Rodney took his passion for engineering into aviation. The original design for the planes was built around an Italian engine. However, shortly after getting the prototypes underway and the production happening, the company that manufactured the engines shut up shop. Rodney and his team now had to innovate more than ever before. Not only were they manufacturing planes, they now decided that they were also going to be in the aircraft engine business. Like all companies, Jabiru came from humble beginnings, from the family garage to ultimately take on the world of aviation with their range of aircraft and aircraft engines. Listen in as Rodney shares some funny tales of being stuck on a remote Queensland island and what it's like to build a plane, get it certified, and then manage to grow a successful aviation business. Well, I'm here with Rodney Stiff from Jabiru Aircraft and Engines. And we're here today on the Australian Aviation Podcast to reminisce a little bit and to celebrate and to look forward to the future. And we're going to talk about 30 years of Jabiru. G'day, Rodney. It's great to have you on the podcast. Welcome to the show, mate.
G'day, Rob.
I'm here also with Owen Zupp. And Owen has had a lot to do with Jabiru. He done a trip around Australia in a J230 in 2010 to celebrate the centenary of flight in Australia. G'day, Owen. How you going, mate?
G'day, Rob. How are you?
Awesome. Really good. Well, congratulations, first of all, Rodney, for being in business for that long. It's a very long time to be doing one thing, never mind manufacturing aeroplanes in Australia. It's a spectacular achievement. I mean, it goes over a period of time there, that anniversary, I suppose, for 30 years. How are you feeling about it all?
Oh, well, you know, we had a little bit of a party at 20 years, and we had another party at 25 years, and then we had another little party at 30 years, so we just keep having parties, you know.
And, any excuse, any anniversary will do, right?
Any anniversary will do. And when you're approaching 80 years old, you don't sort of project out too far, you know. Yeah. But I still buy green bananas, so that's a good sign.
That's the running joke, is it?
Yes. But my doctor advised me not to book that trip to Mars.
Not quite yet. I was reading a blog post about Richard Branson saying we're only weeks away from launching commercial spaceflight now as well. So in your time in aviation, you've seen it all. It's all happening. Right. Tell us a little bit about your background in aviation.
No, I'm just a private pilot.
Mm-hmm. When private did you learn to fly?
And I used to own a Shearer and a Cessna.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, just a private pilot.
When did you learn to fly? How old were you? Can you remember?
Oh, it was in 75 I learned to fly. Mm-hmm. I was 36 years old.
Mm-hmm. And your background is from the sugarcane industry, right? Building all the machines and whatnot's there.
25 years veteran of the sugar industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a lot of my personal effort into that. Yes, from the introduction of mechanisation and the primitive machines that came out in the late 50s, early 60s, right through to the current modern machines. Yes, I was very happy with my contribution to that industry.
And are you an engineer by background?
Yes.
And was it a natural transition to go move over into building aeroplanes and aeroplane engines? Is that something that felt natural to you?
It was extremely difficult because in the 80s, the internet wasn't around.
Mm-hmm.
And to pick up the information you needed when you're located in Bundaberg, you don't have access to a national library or anything. The major problem was getting hold of textbooks that were relevant, and then to do the design process, and then to get suppliers, material, learn new manufacturing techniques. That took a very long time. And I did, in fact, start about 10 years before I abandoned the sugar industry, just working away at home to develop manufacturing techniques that were suitable composite construction. So, yeah, it wasn't just an overnight decision.
I was going to say that, like all good Aussie manufacturing businesses, did it start in the garage or the carport?
In the garage.
pretty kind of typical. And how long was it before you got out of the garage and you actually found yourself in a facility?
About 11 years.
Oh, a long time. You were doing that for a long time.
Yeah, there was a lot of resin on the floor.
Did you drive everybody crazy?
Yes, I might have neglected my family a bit, but I built several prototypes and I only ever got them up to a certain stage, and then I chucked them out and started again. And I did that four, five, six times before I had a plan, because when you quit an executive job with good salary and secretaries and company cars and business class travel and everything else, to start a business where there's just you and you have to roll up your sleeves and do everything, that's a pretty big step.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's a step that brought a few tears to my wife's eyes. And when I announced I was going to risk everything we had to build an aeroplane. So, and if you look at the statistics, or better, you don't look at the statistics, because the number of startup companies that succeed are incredibly low.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, you could count them on the fingers of one hand. The number of startup companies that have made the commercial success in Australia is almost zilch.
The one thing that struck me as I was doing some homework for this interview and I guess reminiscing of the 30 years of Jabiru myself as well, was the really long lead times. It takes a long time to develop and build something, but then it takes an even longer time to get the thing certified. How did you manage and juggle all of those balls at the same time? Because it's a full-time commitment trying to design, manufacture and build something, but then it's a even longer wait to actually get it certified and make it all happen for yourself. How did you manage the business and do that during those? It must have been some tough times.
Well, with great difficulty. And by the time we got to, I had a partner in the business initially, but he and I were both out of the cane harvester factory.
Mm-hmm.
And we only had a meager amount of money, and we had to make that last to cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it didn't last the cash flow, so it meant all our assets were on the line. And CASA were not in a hurry to issue a type certificate, as you can imagine. Yes, I had some very anxious times, and we did get into a lot of debt before we got a cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the cash flow started, it didn't last long before our engine manufacturer quit. And I was faced with the task of starting again with a different brand of engine, or building an engine, take the option of building an engine, because I had to, if I changed the weight of the power of the engine, it meant I had to go back to flight testing and structural testing and what have you, and have the resources to do that.
So for the people listening, that the background on that is that the original aircraft design was built around an Italian engine, right?
Yes, a KFM.
And how long was it that you were a couple of years in and you had a few prototypes, and then that company went out of business and they were no longer building engines?
Yeah, I'd actually built about 17 aeroplanes with that engine.
Gosh.
Then they just, without any rundown, they just said no more. You know, they're
just
not
one day out of the blue, was it? Was there any warning?
Yes. So I jumped on a plane and went to Italy, and couldn't convince them to build another batch, because they built them in batches and they had to buy a lot of components to get enough for a batch. And they said no. So on the way home, on the back of the sick bag, you start sketching. They call sick bag designs, and a lot of them happen when engineers travel on long haul flights. Sick bag design. So yes, I had to start on that, and I come back and announced to my partner Phil that we're going to build an engine. Poor old Phil went white all over and with his teeth.
talk about giant decisions. You know, the decision to manufacture airplanes, and you get a bit of momentum behind you. You got 17 of them there, and then the rug's pulled out from under you. And then you're completely committed to it, right? You've just got to keep moving forward. Is that
That's right.
Approach?
Yeah, my neighbour was the area manager for the bank, and I think I wouldn't have got a loan if it hadn't been for him, but we had to then borrow more money and go on deeper and deeper down the hole.
And how long did it take you before you had your first manufactured engine that you actually put onto an aeroplane? Was it a couple of months or was it a year or two? How long did it take?
It was nearly 2 years.
That's quite a long time, gosh.
Yeah, we had to do CASA. After we did the mandatory 50-hour endurance run, which should have been the end of it, they said, oh, no, that's not good enough. We want 600 flight hours.
Ugh.
So, yeah, Jamie, my long-serving employee, and I were flying 50 hours a week.
Gosh.
Round and round in circles.
Where did you fly? Did you go anywhere or did you just stay in the local area?
Well, that's another story. Yes, I did go. One day I got a bit bored with flying around over the top.
Yeah.
So I decided to fly up the coast and land on the beach, and which I did, but unfortunately the tide was a bit too high and I had a disastrous arrival. Well, actually, my arrival was good, but my departure was very bad, and I tore the wheels off it and things like that.
Did it fly?
I mean, drop and and I was stuck there on the beach and no one knew where I was.
Oh, gosh. And, of course, no phones.
No mobile phones. And would you believe I never took an URSA with me? So there I am sitting there going through the comm, 760 channels, one at a time, and putting out a call on every frequency. But no one heard me anyway.
What did you do? How did you get out of there?
Well, it's a mainland island, and behind the island is an inlet, and in the inlet is a popular place for touring yachties. And as I came in, I noticed that there was a yacht anchored well up inlet behind the island, so I decided to walk over the island. Maybe I could hail the yacht or something, but very, very fortunate they'd just come ashore. So I asked them, told them the predicament, and asked them could they get a message out on the rad phone. By the time, this time, Phil, my partner, had about half a dozen planes out looking for me. They thought I was a goner. Anyway, we got a rad phone. Well, I fell out of the boat, and then we decided the boat was too small, and then it took an hour or more to get up the inlet against the tide and get the boat back and get a message out. But anyway, got a message out. I was okay, and I told Jamie I needed a prop and a front wheel, front leg. So he came up, landed on the beach. Put the front and the low nose leg on and the prop on, but it got me off the beach. But I got a lot of sand in the carburetor when I skidded along on its nose, and that found its way into the engine, and I didn't get very far before it quit. I had to land on another beach, and then it was getting a bit late in the day, so the engine wouldn't go anyway. So Jamie and I had to get off the beach. And the beach was a bit soft, so we had to push and get the plane rolling and then jump in it.
Did you clutch start it, did you? Old school.
We started it, but every time you started it, the wheels started to bog on the wet sand.
Yeah.
So we had to push it to stop the wheels going in the sand and then get air, run on alongside it and then try and get in while it was running.
You're pushing it right. Struts.
For Jamie, he was about 20 years old, but I was a good deal older. Anyway, we got airborne, but home very late. Yeah, that was another story. Next day it got even worse because the engine quit again. But we finally got it home.
Gosh. So the development of an aeroplane and of engines and things like that was that something that you thought that was dangerous? Because, I mean, I'm listening to the story and it sounds like it was kind of a little bit fun, but of course there's a little bit of danger in there as well. Was it a dangerous thing to be doing, to test fly your own aeroplanes and to be building your own stuff?
Yes, it was dangerous. I have to, in reflection, I look at it and I only broke it once. And that was when I was investigating the minimum length of the elevator, and I obviously got below the minimum length and round out on approach, and I ploughed it into the ground. That broke it up in lots of pieces. And yeah, that was a pretty exciting landing. And I had to then revise my numbers on the elevator and put the bits back on that I cut off. But that was another funny one, because it was our first prototype and it was pretty rough and pretty ugly. So I was planning to terminate its use fairly soon. But at that stage, the standards required a maximum gross weight of only 400 kilos. So everything about it was critical in weight, and you didn't need a bigger elevator than you actually had to have. So all the numbers you could do didn't actually tell you what the minimum was, but the only way was to discover what the minimum was and do that was a bit dodgy, actually. And anyway, I plowed into the ground because I cut too much of it. Anyway, the plane was broken and it was late in the afternoon because I wasn't allowed to fly the aeroplane then. NASA deemed I wasn't good enough to be a test pilot. So I used to sneak out just on dark and do my little hops around the airport and then thinking no one's seen me, you see. But this time I hit the ground. Unfortunately, I left a bit of fiberglass laying on the runway. And somebody spotted me or something, but they felt it their duty to tell the CASA.
Oh, right.
And at that point, there was an enforcer in Brisbane whose common name was Colonel Clink. And he was duly come stomping up here, but we cut the plane up and took it to the dump before he got here. And when he got here, he couldn't find it. So he had to go back to Brisbane.
What aeroplane? What accident?
What aeroplane? Anyway, that's a long time ago, and hopefully, I think he'd be deceased by now, but I could probably tell that story.
Very nice, very nice. How long was it before you got the actual CASA certification for your aeroplane?
3 years and 10 months.
Mm-hmm. What year was it when you got it?
I started in January 88, and it was September 91.
Fantastic. Was that like a... Tell me about the milestone. Was it massive or was it just like a relief or was it just something, okay, we got it now, let's just keep going forward?
It was just a great relief. I didn't have time for celebrations.
Yeah.
The fuse was burning and we had to get that cash coming back in.
Yeah.
And it was go, go, go. But I might say to all likely entrepreneurs that are out there and think it's a great way of making money building airplanes, I could tell them to forget it. I got real estate or something like that. But the very, very important thing is the large amount of time that I had in manufacturing. Most people come into building aeroplanes as enthusiasts or pilots, but you must have a manufacturing background. If you're going to succeed, the aeroplane has to be designed to be manufactured from day one.
Mm-hmm.
If it flies, that's a secondary effect. But the important thing is it must be designed to be manufactured. And it must be designed to be manufactured in low volume. Mass production techniques are not applicable to light aircraft industry. And this is where so many companies go wrong. Volume is not there to support the investment you need. So you have to be very, very clever in the way you design the airplane so it can be built on low-cost tooling where there is not a massive investment to get to production. This is most startup companies fail at that point because they design metal airplanes or they design something that needs massive amount of capital injection, even to get the prototype built, get through certification and so on. It's the manufacturing technology that will make it or break you. That's the important message to those would-be startup out there. And if you're over 40, I advise you not to start because you haven't got enough time left.
Yeah. Was that something that you knew about manufacturing at the outset or was that something that you learned along the way?
I learned a lot about manufacturing in the sugar industry because, in fact, we built very complex machines in low volume and everything you did had to be matched to a manufacturing process that you could afford,
mm-hmm.
one you would like to have. So that is the key to the success of Jabiru is that it was designed to be manufactured. It was not an enthusiast airplane. It was designed to be manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
And also it was designed way up in the design requirements was crashworthiness. And that is the thing that's really stuck to us. We are now shining way up there as probably the safest aeroplane in the category statistically. And it's a statistic that's open for everyone to see in both UK, America, South Africa and Australia. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
The fatality rate on Jabiru aeroplanes is so low compared to the nearest competitor.
Yeah, I did see that information on your website, again, as I was researching for this interview.
And were you impressed?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I was suitably impressed. And that's because I guess it's not a statistic that a normal...
You know, people don't really want to talk about it. And for years, I would never talk about it.
Yeah.
But now I got pushed into a corner recently, as you'll know, and I had to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
When Susan did the research and when we looked at the figures, it was quite outstanding. There was nothing on the market anywhere near us.
Yeah, it's not even close to the safety record and how good they are. Yeah, it's fantastic. It's definitely something to be proud of. What? Tell me, Rod, what has been over the – you had some really hard challenges at the outset there with CASA and getting certification, then your engines. What would you see as the biggest challenge that you've faced over the last 30 years? Because there's a lesson in there for everybody. You know, it's about manufacturing. You mentioned that, and that's a really good lesson that people just wouldn't know unless you're in that space. What do you think the biggest challenge has been for you?
Well, the GFC changed the world. Global financial crisis changed the world. We were running on a straight line growth from running up to the GFC. We were virtually going up every year for the previous 10 years. We were just going up on a straight line. And I thought, and you get overconfident and you think this is going to keep going. And it just collapsed overnight. And the first victim of a recession is discretionary spending, in other words, toys.
Yep.
And people stopped buying toys. And I think I could be forgiven for saying some figures, but we had a straight line growth, and we were up to 24 million in turnover, put a number on it. 242 aeroplanes in 1 year.
Wow.
And we were averaging for that year 70, 80 engines a month.
Wow.
And, you think there's no tomorrow because, this is clever, this is happening. And then wham, bam, kazam, overnight, all our Ford orders disappeared, as they did for Cessna. Our engine market stopped. And we had to restructure the company down to about a 5 million turnover from 24 million.
Wow. Really big dip.
Now, most people can manage a company in growth, but I tell you what, to manage a company in recess takes a lot more skill.
Yeah.
And it's a skill I learned in the sugar industry, because when you're attached to the commodity market, sugar industry particularly, you get these massive swings of demand, world excess, the price goes through the floor. You got 10 bags too many and the price sinks. You've got 10 bags too few and the price goes up. That took a lot of managing when we had a fairly big workforce and a lot of capital commitment, a damn lot of managing, but we managed it. And but the reason Jabiru survived that downturn is because I managed the company with no debt. I got rid of all my debt. I had a cash surplus. And that time hit and we could ride it out. We never had to put any staff off. We kept our own core staff. Like the business was arranged with core staff of 20-odd people, and which we still have, and contractors, subcontractors to make components and do services for us. So we managed a huge – we had up to 150 total people working on the project pre-GFC. So, yes, it was hard on the contractors, it was hard on all the suppliers, but – we kept our core skills, and those people are still with me, and most of have. I got a lot of people here with 20 years of service. Jamie still with me at 28 years of service.
Long time.
My second employee, a couple of my early employees retired at 25 years, which is what I thought, but just because they're old. But, yeah, so we kept our core skills. And as we didn't have any debt, we were able to just plug along.
So take me forward in time. After the GFC, you have this really hard economic downturn with the business. Has it taken time to catch back up? Has it caught back up for you? Are you back on track, hitting some numbers?
No. A lot of things happened after the GFC. First of all, the A dollar went up to $1.10 to the US dollar. Wiped out any remnants of an export market that you might have. And then Europe come online, Eastern Bloc come online with a whole proliferal. Well, the next thing that happened is a sport plane category came in where manufacturers could self-certify. Previously, certification had to be done by the authorities, and it was a very costly and lengthy process. Self-certification was a great thing for light sport, but it was a bad thing in a lot of ways. It let too many people into the market. So now there are more than 100 manufacturers, and with the 300 different aircraft on the market, whereas in the beginning we had probably the first sharp and shiny aeroplane that had a reasonable performance and a good degree of safety and so on, but we lost that initiative, the impetus that we had initially, and now we've got to fight it out with the rest of the gang. But there are only two engine manufacturers in our category. So engine manufacturer is our prime interest now. Mm-hmm. And there's less competition in that area. So we've just...
And you've got worldwide distribution, don't you? I noticed you've got resellers in various different countries and distributors in various different countries. How many different countries are you in?
Oh, I haven't counted them lately.
Lots, right?
Yeah, we've got planes in all sorts of funny places. Vladivostok, I love that name.
Yeah.
And Mongolia and...
really obscure places, right?
Pacific Islands and in the drug trade, I think.
Have you been fortunate enough to travel to some of those places, some of those exotic locations?
Yes. Nowadays, I get to choose where I go. When I was in the sugar industry, I didn't get to choose, and I end up in some bloody awful places. But now I choose, and I generally tend to go to the more civilized ones. But yeah, like USA and England and South Africa and Europe and so on.
Is there one market opportunity that's bigger than the other that you guys are focusing on?
The US is starting to come back, which is good, because the A-dollar is making our product attractive. And the fact we've been in there so long, there's the confidence building back up again for our product. And you can see it happening. It'll never get back to what it was because of the competition. But notably, you should mention the big names that actually came into the light sport category and then disappeared very quickly, like Piper and Cessna.
Piper, yeah, I was going to say that, yeah.
Yeah, they made very fast retreats with their...
Touching.
They said, whoops.
Yeah, oopsie.
Bad idea. Let's get the hell out of here because it didn't fit their corporate structure and their overheads, you know, massive overheads in those companies, and they really couldn't compete. Mm-hmm. And light engineering and, you know, ultralight engineering, as we have to, requires a very high degree of skill. It's not easy.
I want to shift focus a little bit from business and manufacturing to something kind of really cool and fun and operational and about flying the aeroplanes. Tell me, what are they like to fly?
Well, would you ask a Ford salesman what about a Holden, you know?
It's a loaded question. I want to hear all the really good things about it.
Well, they fit the purpose for which they were designed. They were designed as an ab initio trainer, and some of them can take a brutal punishment as an ab initio can train. We've got two down at Victoria at one flying school that in January will clock up 20,000 hours between them.
Wow.
10,000 hours each, and it's all been done on circuits and bumps.
Gosh.
And we have many out in the field with over 8,000 hours on them. So they can take the punishment. The airframes can take the punishment. The engines have to be properly maintained. If properly maintained, they can take the punishment. They are designed to go cross-country, particularly the 230, which Owen can vouch, can fly around Australia and in comfort. I've flown around Australia a couple of times. I've been up to Thursday Island back, and regularly we do 5-hour legs, you know.
And she cruises at like 100, 120 knots in that?
120 knots in a 230 is a proper number. It's got a max speed of 138 knots at sea level on a good day.
And what about on juice? She's pretty lean on the juice as well, right?
It will burn 23 to 26, depends who's flying it, what altitude you fly, how well you fly. Like everything else, if you spend all day climbing out of holes, you're going to burn more fuel. Mm-hmm. If you get it high enough and trim it out, it'll
go for hours.
It's all about pilot skills. It's got plenty of room to chuck luggage in the back, or in the amateur bill area, we put four seats in them. It can carry four people. It's a marvel of what it can carry.
Tell me about the controls in the middle. That's a little bit different to the little bug smashers that I've flown before with the yoke, and then I've flown one with a stick in between my legs, but then now I've got a control column in the middle. It's quite different. What's that like to learn on? Well, that must be...
There's lots of reasons for that, but one of the main reasons it sticks in the middle is so that when you crash it, it doesn't stick you through the belly. Crashworthiness has a major impact on the design of the cabin. And also the weight restrictions on the design. I used push-pull cables, which gave me a lot more freedom to build a lightweight design than using conventional cables and pulleys systems. They were just too complex and too heavy, but I didn't want to put anything in front of the pilot that could stick him in a crash.
Mm-hmm.
But the push-pull cables have been a fantastic success.
Nice. Owen, I'm going to get you to jump in here and tell us about your experience flying the 230 around Australia and the there and back trip.
Yeah, Rob, I also flew one Jabiru supplied for the centenary of Airmail some years ago. So I've had a couple of very good opportunities to fly them, and I can only echo what Rod said about its performance. And the numbers he said were spot on, because I still remember over 70 hours plus flying around Australia, it was virtually right on 120 knot cruise, Taz. And I think over all those hours, I worked out about 23.8 litres an hour, I think it was, that on that flight around Australia. But there's so many aspects of it that I found. It could do a short hop, or it could do those long sectors across the Kimberley, and it was comfortable. And the other thing, doing a flight like that, I carried a spare wheel. Mm-hmm. I carried supplies that if I went down in the Kimberley in the dry, so a fair share of water, and yet I had to carry cold weather gear and water rations, etc., going down south. And it was, I always likened it to a sports car come ute, because I had all this gear in the back,
mm-hmm.
I had me in the front, and I could always fuel it to full tanks. So if I landed, I could know that I could put it in full fuel and I'd be within weight limits, even with all that gear in the back. So to do a flight like that, it was a perfect aeroplane. And the high wing for the visibility when you want to take it all in, it was very nice, I must admit. So I found it to be efficient. I found it to be comfortable. And the numbers that Rod quoted were virtually spot on. And that's over an extended period. That's not me having one short hop. That's right around Australia. I worked all the numbers out, and I think it was 23.8 litres an hour I averaged from memory. Yeah.
Fantastic. I watched a video on the Jabiru website with an AFL football player. I can't remember the guy's name, but he looked like he's a pretty tall fella, big, tall, lanky guy. And the Jabiru has got like a low stature, and he kind of had to duck right down to look under the wing and do his walk around and whatnot. But as soon as he got in the thing, it fit him like a glove. It was perfect. It looked like there was plenty of room in there for him, and he must have been 6'3", 6'4", something like that. How did you go in the plane, Owen? Did you fit in it all right?
Oh, absolutely. And there's almost an advantage in that wing being at that height. You can see readily whether your fuel caps are on properly, to be perfectly honest.
Don't need a ladder.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about access and egress to so many, you know, sports cars even. But once you're in there, as I said, it was very comfortable for me. I'm 5'10", so I'm no giant, but I flew a European brand of aircraft at one stage of my career, quite an amount, and it was a bigger aeroplane, but I tell you what, your headsets were hitting the roof all the time. There was no such problem with the Jabiru. And that's one thing I should mention. There's a lot of simplicity about it too, just the simple door mechanisms, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there's a lot to be said for that simplicity when you're building something like an aircraft. Sometimes we can get a little cute.
That was my very next question for you, Rod, was about the changes that we've seen in the last couple of years in technology, the advancements in all sorts of computer technology, and I guess in manufacturing it spills over there as well. How has that affected you in the last 10 years? Has it affected you or not really?
Yes, it has, particularly in the manufacture of the engines. The airframe manufacture hasn't changed. It's a hand layup, a wet layup. You know, it's hand labor. Simple tools like a 3-inch paint roller, and there's nothing high tech about the airframe manufacture at all. But in respect to the engine manufacture, yes, there is. And in our R&D section, I have two young graduate engineers work for me, and on the outside, we don't walk around in white coats and have laboratories and everything else, but we've got some very high tech gear here, and we can research all manner of things. And I'm just amazed. You see, the digital age left me behind. I decided I wouldn't try and keep up. I've got a pencil and paper, and I sketch things and give it to these guys, and my God, they're fast, and they can draw these things faster than I could ever do it with a pencil and paper. And we can get 3D images, and we can turn them upside down and look inside out. And we can download that stuff to CNC control machines and make incredible parts with terrific accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
We've got coordinate measuring machines that can measure to 2 microns, and we've got strong test facilities for testing raw material and things for looking inside cylinders when their engines are running and stuff like that. And yes, we don't present a high-tech image, and we don't pretend to. But yes, we've got all the gear, and where we don't have the gear, we employ the best people to do it. So yes, technology, particularly in respect to 3D drawings, they're just beautiful. You can produce parts, books and sections. And one element, one process we use a lot is finite element analysis. These two guys here are just brilliant. And they can show me a 3D model with coloured to all the stress levels. You can find the points of maximum stress in a blink, you know, when you take some oil to set the models up. But you can alter the load. You can look at the result of the work. It's just fantastic. I mean, I had none.
Are you using that as diagnostic tools? Are you using that in manufacturing and building new things?
Well, the CNC equipment is used in manufacturing, but manufacturing, yep. The rest is used in research and development. Oh, yes, and we recently bought a little 3D printer, and everyone should have a 3D printer. They're great gadgets. They're incredible what they can do. And I really need a big one, you know, but it'll come out of next year's budget. But 3D printers are just normal, what they can print in plastic. And now I'd like to be able to print in metal. They do that on the space station, but that's not my budget, doesn't go that far.
Will that change the way things are manufactured with 3D printing?
Oh, we got to use it for making small plastic parts that we used to machine from solid.
Yep.
On CNC machinery, but we can make them on this stuff. But we prototype a lot of stuff with it. Great for prototyping. But when Owen was saying about what you can chuck in the back, look, I'll tell you a story, but I won't mention any names, but I can tell you that you can carry a calf and a dog, no problem at all. But the calf was very quiet. You know, the guy assured me the calf was very quiet because it was a bit ill. That's why he was taking it home for his wife to look after. Gosh. The calf was in the back, so he had to put the dog in the front.
Can all be done, see?
It can all be done.
Perfect machine for it.
Yeah, I've heard of some pretty strange loads going in the back, and yes, that's what that big back gets used for. But the important thing is the centre of gravity, the J230 is designed to carry a load in the back as a four-seater. So as a port plane, you're not frightened of going through the back centre of gravity limits.
You can load it up okay. That's cool.
You can load it up okay, yeah.
Nice. Well, I noticed that there's a twin Jabiru getting around, and there's a couple of different flavours of that from the different pictures that I've seen. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
No, there's different colours, but they're the same flavour.
Is it the one plane?
One is in South Africa, one's here.
Okay.
We built a kit and sent it to South Africa, and then later put it onto one of his planes over there.
Mm-hmm.
And we built one here, and Jamie put it on his plane. And we're currently doing some more work on that to make it more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Remodel the pods and reduce the drag, and maybe we can reduce its VMC a little bit and make it more user-friendly. But it is very user-friendly as a twin, but I think we can do better and make it look better. Some people have said that only a mother could love it, but other people say it looks good. Where do you draw the line? But we can make it look better. So
there's still some work to do on it still.
Yeah, as always. It's a low priority project, but I'm not going to certify it. It's only going into the amateur belt category.
Right.
Ex-airline pilots like two throttles, Owen. We were talking to some of your compatriots down at Cessnock, and yes, it seemed to attract the ex-airline pilot.
Nice. That's a particular market.
They have a lot less trouble getting their wives' approval when it's got two engines.
With two engines, see?
Yes.
You mentioned you sent it across as a kit. If someone was going to buy a J230 or something like that, and it was their first build, how long would that take somebody? What sort of skill set would they need to do that?
Accountants don't do too good. Accountants and bank managers, but we've had all people from all walks of life build these things.
Uh-huh.
And we always say it's 600-700 hours, and people have built it in that time. Pretty rough, quick. Other people just want to treat it as a hobby and take as long as it takes. But yeah, I would expect it to be built in about 600-700 hours. It would go a lot quicker if you got somebody else to do the painting that was good at painting. Mm-hmm. The actual build time is quite low. Because you get a full kit. I mean, you get everything, every part you need, you get. You don't have to go out and buy stuff.
Do you have to have any sort of qualification or skill set to be able to do it?
No. Including the accountants.
Again, that's a deliberately loaded question. I've seen how you handled it. Beautifully said. Well, Rod, it's been really great to spend a bit of time with you and reminisce a little bit about what's happened in the last 30 years. I know it's hard to look forward in aviation or in any business for that length of time. Can you look forward maybe 5 or 10 years for me and tell me what exciting things are coming down the pipeline for you guys?
Rob, do you realise how old I'll be in 10 years' time?
And we'll do another podcast at 35 years.
All right. Okay, we'll make an appointment. I think it'll be just more of the same. I think we'll call back some market in the engines. We'll take a bit of... I've got some new developments coming along in engines which will probably attract more buyers. And the A-dollar plays a big important part. Australian labour is... Australian manufacturing is really very difficult because of our labour costs. So we have to look to spreading our costs into other countries. In other words, we have to get components made offshore to control our costs, which we do and we have done for many years, so that we can offer the product at a very competitive price, which we do. So it's just a matter of working currencies to just keep topping up some Australian content, most Australian content, some imported content, imported from all sorts of places. We get our dipsticks made in India.
Of all places.
Yes.
Of all places.
Yes, and they make a fantastic job and they're as cheap as chips. But you have to buy a couple of thousand of them. So anyone that's short of a dipstick, we've got plenty.
I might just leave that one right there, yeah? There's plenty of places we could go with that, but I'll leave that one right there. All right, last question, parting question. Tell me what it was like to receive the Order of Australia Medal from the Governor General.
Oh, mixed feelings there. Yeah, it was okay. It was okay, but mixed feelings there. The cucumber sandwiches were good.
It was with Quentin Bryce, wasn't it?
Yes. She gave her husband one later. She gave her husband one later on.
Oh. Very nice.
So you get what I'm coming from?
Yes, I do.
You get where I'm coming from?
Well, that's a fantastic achievement and a really good milestone in a very long career. Rod, we really appreciate you spending some time with us here on the Australian Aviation Podcast, mate. Congratulations on 30 years of Jabiru. That's an unbelievable achievement. I know it's just kind of taking it all in your stride and you're very modest about it all, but it is really a spectacular achievement, mate. Congratulations to you and all of your team. And here's to the next 30 years of Jabiru in Australia, mate. Thanks very much for spending some time with us.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks also, Owen, for joining us on the show as well.
No worries at all, Rob. Great to chat with you.
All right, bye, guys.
See you, guys.
Well, there you have it, folks. What an inspirational story of innovation and grind. No business is easy, and manufacturing, especially in Australia and in the aviation industry, is no small feat. Congratulations to you, Rodney, and all the team at Jabiru, and we look forward to the next 30 years of this wonderful Australian company. Now, if you haven't already got the latest edition of Australian Aviation, you can pick up a copy at your local newsagent. And if you'd rather save yourself the trip, you can have it delivered to your letterbox each month with one of our new memberships. You might have noticed that we've recently changed the way that our memberships work. You can now pick up a platinum membership for just $19 per month. And your annual membership includes 11 copies of Australian Aviation and Aviator magazine. You'll receive both the digital and hard copies of both magazines. You'll get a 20% discount of the AvPlan EFB subscriptions. You get priority tickets for aviation events, an Australian Aviation cap and keyring, plus you receive 4 entries into the draw to win 2 tickets to Oshkosh 2019. Just visit our website at australianaviation.com.au and click on the members tab for some more information. Now, if you have a question or a comment, you can reach out to us at any time at mail@australianaviation.com.au. Well, that wraps it up for the show today. I'm Robert Bruss, and until next time, happy aviating, and it's bye for now.